graphic audio, a movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents Duel at Lohawk. Narrated by Terrence Hazel Ford. With performances by James Keegan, Richard Rowan, Patrick Busink, Ren Casey, Eva Wilhelm, Gregory Gorton, Gary Tells, Michael John Casey, Bradley Smith, Tim Carlin, Michael Glenn, Joe Brack, Alyssa Wilmoth, Nanette Savard, Jeff Allen, Casey Platt, Katie Karkov, Christopher Graybill, Christopher Sheeran, Elizabeth Jernigan, Daniel Sontag, and David Coyne.
It was a chilly spring morning when they opened the outer gate at Arkansas State Prison and ushered Boot Stoner outside the wall. Owning nothing more than the suit of clothes the state of Arkansas issued him upon release, he was penniless and far from home. It was 200 miles as the crow flies from Little Rock to the trading post his father had built 18 miles north of Fort Gibson in the Cherokee Nation. And Boot had no way to get there other than on foot. Home was the only place he knew to go at this juncture in his life, even though his father had kicked him out long before he was arrested. He took one last look at the place that had been his home for the past 12 years.
I'll be damned if I'll ever see this place again.
This promise to himself was not made because he had learned his lesson and planned to walk the straight and narrow. Far from it. As he saw it, society owed him a hell of a lot for locking him up for most of his young years, and he intended to collect upon that debt with interest. As for his vow never to return, the law would have to kill him next time. He had seen all of the inside of those walls he intended to see. Boot had been given a paper verifying his time served, and advised that he must report to the Federal District Office in Fort Smith within 5 days. There had evidently been no consideration given to the fact that he would have to walk 125 miles in that time. It made little difference to Boot Stoner. He planned to ignore the directive anyway. Although just appointed to the Western District the year before, Judge Isaac C. Parker was a name with which Boot was familiar, and he had no intention of ever seeing the man. His only plan was to head straight for Indian Territory. If the opportunity presented itself along the way, he would steal a horse to carry him. If not, he would walk every step of the way. Lean and hard and prison tough, Boot was capable of walking to the Pacific Ocean if necessary. There were certain things that he intended to give some long-awaited attention. Foremost among these was to settle with one Jacob Mashburn. Mashburn's testimony was the key piece of evidence that slammed the prison door on Boot Stoner. Boot knew there was no chance that Mashburn had seen him steal a horse from his corral, but Mashburn pointed him out and swore that Boot was the man. The fact that Boot actually did steal the Red Roan was beside the point. It was in the dark of night, and Mashburn could not have been certain if the thief was Boot or any of the other three rustlers who stampeded the cattle. The fact that Boot was a half-breed seemed to help the judge believe Mashburn's eyewitness report. At any rate, Boot planned to make Mashburn pay for his testimony. He walked until dark on his first day of freedom, leaving the town of Little Rock behind him. Passing isolated farms along the dusty road, he gave no thought to food or drink until the sun began to settle upon the horizon. Approaching a modest farmhouse in the twilight of the evening, Boot decided it was time to acquire the supplies and transportation he needed. 5-year-old Margaret Woodcock slipped out of the house and ran to the barn to say goodnight to the new calf. Margaret's father had told her it could be her calf, but she would have to accept the responsibility for feeding and taking care of it. A week old now, the calf still looked to its mother for nourishment, in spite of Margaret's attempts to feed it from a pail. Her father said it was important to wean the calf from its mother as soon as possible, so Margaret had faithfully accompanied her father at milking time every day, and after he had drawn milk for the family, he left some in the bottom of the pail. It was Margaret's job to wet her fingers with milk and put them in the calf's mouth. When the calf began to suck the milk from her fingers, Margaret would gently lower the calf's head into the bucket, where, hopefully, it would learn to drink. Since the new calf was reluctant to learn, Margaret had decided to name it Pokey. Margaret paused for a moment to let her eyes adjust to the darkness. It was a small barn with only 4 stalls, and Pokey was in the first stall with her mama. Margaret went directly to the stall, oblivious to the dark shadow by the rear wall where her father's mule was kept.
Pokey, if you don't start drinking out of that bucket in the morning, I don't know.
She was carried roughly to the rear of the barn.
If you make one little squeak, I'll choke the life out of you. You understand?
She nodded fearfully, her eyes wide with terror, the stale stench of sweat filling her nostrils. With one hand firmly in place around the child's neck, Boot slowly removed the other from her mouth.
Now, if you behave yourself and tell me what I want to know, maybe I won't kill you. Who's in the house? Your mama and daddy?
Margaret answered with a nod.
Anybody else?
She shook her head. He thought it over for a moment. His initial plan had been to simply steal the mule and maybe take a couple of the hens nesting in the barn for his supper. But now he had to do something about the little girl who had stumbled in at the wrong time. With a grim nod to himself, he smiled at Margaret and slowly tightened the hand around the child's throat. Boot took no particular satisfaction in the taking of a human life. It was merely a matter of convenience, the elimination of a possible minor irritation. In fact, the child was his first murder, and it meant little more to him than the killing of a sickly puppy. Boot picked up a pitchfork and started for the house. Constance Woodcock turned to glance at the door. She was stunned by the appearance of the dark, ominous stranger who came into the room. Robert Woodcock, who was seated at the table, sprang to his feet. The half-breed, in cold, unhurried response, shoved Constance aside and met her charging husband head-on. Holding the handle like a battering ram, Boot drove the hapless farmer across the room and into the opposite wall. Constance glanced at the fireplace and the double-barreled shotgun propped beside it. Boot followed the direction of her gaze and took a step toward the fireplace. Abandoning thoughts of reaching it in time, Constance bolted through the open doorway, running for her life. Boot grabbed the shotgun, then charged out the door after her. Even in the darkness, Constance was an easy target. Much to Boot's surprise, she almost immediately tried to struggle to her feet. Disgusted, it occurred to him then that Robert Woodcock's shotgun was loaded with birdshot. Boot set upon her with both hands around her neck. After returning to the house, Boot stood before the dying man pinned to the wall and coldly considered Robert's pitiful suffering. Irritated by the noises the man was making, Boot placed the muzzle of the shotgun inches from Robert's face. With all quiet now, Boot began to take inventory of his gains. With the Woodcock's home and belongings completely at his disposal, Boot decided there was no need for haste. It was fairly late in the evening by then, and he figured there was little possibility of neighbors coming to call. He gave a thought toward the probability that the farmer might have a hired hand who could conceivably report for work in the morning. Even so, that gave him the entire night to satisfy his needs. His first priority was food. He hadn't eaten a solid meal in 10 years, having survived on the gruel prepared by the prison kitchen. In view of this, he decided he would now have a feast. Remembering the calf in the barn, he found a butcher knife in the kitchen and went out to the barn to slaughter Margaret's pet. He roasted it over the fire in the fireplace and stuffed himself with the tender beef, oblivious to the grotesque corpse pinned to the wall. When he was properly filled, he ransacked the house for anything useful. Taking the shotgun and some staples from the kitchen, along with a blanket, he went back to the barn to find a bridle for the mule. With still a good 2 hours before daylight, Boot departed the Woodcock homestead, his new possessions bundled in the blanket and the shotgun in his hand. It was a long ride on a slow-walking mule to Indian territory.
Damn it, mule. If you don't pick up the pace, I'll stick this shotgun in your ear.
It was infuriating to Boot Stoner, but he had no choice except to put up with it. A slow ride still beat walking to Oklahoma territory. Crossing into Indian territory south of Fort Smith, on the northern fringe of the winding Stair Mountains, Boot noted that almost 5 full days had passed since leaving the bodies of the Woodcock family behind. He made his way past the Sandboys Mountains, reaching the Canadian River, where he made camp at nightfall. The river was fairly wide at that point, but the water was not deep. He crossed the river and continued along his way. Another 3 days saw him finally reach the Arkansas River. After spending a good portion of the afternoon searching for a way to cross, he decided to swim the mule across. With no desire to take a swim, the mule refused to enter the water until Boot set upon it, using the shotgun as a club. Finally, the mule gave in. With Boot hanging onto his tail, holding the shotgun up over his head and a half a dozen matches in his teeth, the mule made the other side some 50 yards downstream from the point of embarkation. Soaked to the bone in the chilly water, Boot staggered ashore behind the mule. Scrambling up the bank, he released the mule's tail, which proved to be a huge mistake, for the mule kept going.
Damn stupid animal!
The bird shot only caused the mule to run faster.
You're lucky, son.
On foot again, the irate half-breed retraced his steps to pick up the matches he'd managed to keep dry, but lost when he opened his mouth to shout at the departing mule. With the Boston Mountains on his right, Boot walked north up the valley toward Wendell Stoner's trading post on the Grand River. Wendell Stoner had built his trading post on the bank of the Grand, or the Neosho, as some called it. The trading post consisted of a store for his trade goods and a cabin attached to it for his living quarters. With treeless prairie for hundreds of yards both north and south of his store, Wendell could see his customers approaching from a great distance. On this spring afternoon, a lone stranger on foot was sighted by Wendell's wife, Morning Light.
Wendell, there's someone coming.
Wendell's eyes riveted to the approaching figure. Then he turned to look at his wife for a long moment.
Can't be.
Her eyes reflected the dread concern that he had instantly felt. Turning his gaze back toward their visitor, he knew even at that distance there was no mistaking the slight slouch in the man's walk, as if constantly stalking something or someone.
Boot.
He was sure of it, and a feeling of trepidation, absent for these past 12 years, now returned. Carrying a bundle in one hand, and with what appeared to be a shotgun propped on his shoulder, the prodigal son had come home. Looking up then, Boot discovered his mother and father watching him. Just as they had, he gave no sign of greeting as he neared the little store. Boot dropped his bundle and propped the shotgun against it.
Well, well, well. If it ain't Mama and Papa come out to meet me. You two don't look like you're happy to see me.
What the hell are you doing back here, Boot? Did you break out of prison?
Hell no. I served my time, so they'd let me out. I knew my mama would want to see me as soon as I got out. I need some things.
I told you when you started running with Billy Sorefoot and that bunch not to come around here no more. You've caused me and your mother enough grief. See, you best just keep right on walking.
Now, ain't that a fine way to welcome your only son back home? Like I said, I need some things. The sooner I get them, the sooner I'll be on my way.
Well, there ain't much I can help you with. Some food, some clothes, maybe. That's about it.
And a horse and a rifle and some cartridges and maybe...
A slight movement from the corner of the cabin window caught his attention.
Who the hell's inside?
Nobody.
Nobody, hell. I just saw somebody peeping out the window.
It ain't nobody. It's just your sister. Leave her be.
My sister? Hell, I didn't know I had a sister.
She ain't really your sister. She's a little creek girl we took in 2 years ago when her parents was drowned. She ain't no concern of yours.
Come on out here, sister. So I can take a look at you.
When there was no response, he lost interest and quickly changed the subject.
You know, I've been walking a long way. I'm tired and hungry. When a man comes home after 12 years, he ought to be offered something besides rude talk.
Well, I reckon we can give you something to eat. But don't go getting no ideas about staying.
Wendell nodded to his wife. She went inside immediately.
What's my sister's name?
Lily. It's any of your business.
Yes, sir. This is one fine homecoming.
In a few minutes, Morning Light returned with a plate of food and handed it to Boot. He immediately set upon it with a ravenous appetite.
Cold beans and biscuits. Some banquet for my homecoming.
That's all there is right now.
Ain't you got no coffee?
Lily, pour a cup of coffee and fetch it here.
A few minutes later, a slight creek girl appeared in the cabin doorway holding a cup of coffee.
Well, Lily, no wonder they was hiding you. You ain't no little girl at all. How old are you?
Instinctively protective, Morning Light took the cup from her daughter and stepped between the girl and the unwelcome guest.
She ain't but 14, near as we know. Never you mind about her.
Boot merely smiled in reply, but continued to ogle the young Indian girl. When Lily had returned to the cabin, Boot cleaned up the last of the beans and tossed the plate on the ground.
All right. Let's go in the store and see what I need.
Without waiting for Wendell's reaction, he pushed past his father and walked into the store.
I worked hard for this merchandise. I ain't planning to give it all away to the likes of you.
Hell, I don't want all of it. I just want what I need.
I don't owe you a damn thing.
Well, somebody does. And it looks like you're the only one standing here.
Boot began picking items off the shelves. A pair of trousers, a shirt, some tobacco, a coat, and laid them on the counter.
I need a rifle. I see cartridges, but I don't see no rifle.
You know I don't sell guns.
But I bet by God you got a couple in the cabin. I expect I'll be needing one. And a pistol, too.
You can take them clothes there, and that's all I'm giving you. Take them and leave us be.
Old man, you don't understand, do you? I'll decide what I'll take. When I get through here, we'll take a look at them two horses you got in the corral back there. I'm damn tired of walking.
I'll be goddamn, you ain't taking no horse.
We'll see about that.
Boot pushed through the door to the cabin attached to the trading post with Wendell right behind him. He knew exactly where he was heading. Striding past the startled creek girl, he made straight through the curtain that closed off his parents' bedroom.
I see you keep them in the same place.
Boot picked up one of the two rifles propped in a corner by the bed.
Put it back, Boot.
This is one of them new Winchesters, ain't it? I remember that old Remington, but this here Winchester, that's a hell of a rifle. An old man like you ain't got no use for a rifle like this.
All right. You can take the Remington, and I'll give you cartridges to go with it, but I need that Winchester.
That old Remington's good enough for you, old man. You ain't got nothing to shoot at but jackrabbits and groundhogs. I got better use for this one. Hell, I'll even leave you my shotgun. Now I'll need your saddle.
I ain't got no saddle to spare. And I'll be damned if I'm gonna let you take mine or Morning Light's.
As Boot started toward the door, Wendell reached out and grabbed him by his sleeve.
No horse and no saddle. Now you get the hell off my land.
I'm warning you, old man.
Wendell lunged for the rifle in Boot's other hand. His son struck him with the butt of the rifle. Boot whirled around just in time to confront his mother with a pistol in her hand. His lightning quick reaction was to level the Winchester and pull the trigger.
No!
Wendell, on hands and knees, staggered to his feet and lurched toward Boot. Lily was unable to move for several long moments. Standing over his murdered parents, Boot stared dispassionately at the bodies that had given him birth.
It's their own damn fault. They shouldn't have come at me like that.
Suddenly realizing that she might be next, Lily brought herself out of her paralysis and bolted for the door. Boot charged out after her. The young Creek girl was lithe and swift, but she was no match for Boot in an all-out sprint. The two of them rolled over and over into the meadow grass with Boot winding up on top.
Ain't no use in running. Nah, I ain't fixing to kill you, little sister. I got better use for you.
Keeping a firm grip on the girl's arm, he got to his feet and pulled her up.
Now, I expect we best get ready to travel.
Boot had tied Lily hand and foot and left her lying on the floor next to her adoptive parents, while he ransacked the store and cabin for anything useful. Satisfied that he was now armed and supplied, he had gone out to the corral to saddle the two horses. Just as he was about to lead the horses out of the corral, he saw two riders approaching the trading post. He paused to study them for a few moments before deciding they were harmless visitors. With rifle in hand, he walked out to the front of the store and awaited them. When they were a little closer, he identified them as Cherokees, maybe father and son, probably regular customers of his father's.
Howdy. Need flour and salt. Where's Wendell?
Wendell ain't here. Him and Morning Light gone on a trip.
The two Cherokee exchanged confused glances, not sure what to think. To the older man, there was something familiar about the stranger. He felt sure he had seen him before, but he would have to give it some thought before it came to him.
The store's closed.
The Cherokees considered the surly young half-breed standing before them, casually cradling Wendell's rifle, and decided it best to take their leave. Without further questions, they wheeled their ponies and departed. Boot went inside the cabin.
Come on, girl. It's time to go.
Wendell Stoner's saddle was nothing a man could brag about. Old and worn, the girth was frayed on both edges, causing Boot to wonder how much longer it would be before the straps separated and dumped his behind on the ground. It would have to do for a while, he decided, at least until he had an opportunity to find a better one. Morning Light's saddle was in much the same condition, bearing evidence that neither saddle had been used very often. It was a light Indian saddle made of wood with carved cantle and horn. When he placed the saddle on the little gray mare's back and drew up on the girth, it caused the weathered wood to split.
Ah, God damn it.
Disgusted, Boot pulled the saddle off and threw it aside. He glared at the girl cowering in the corner of the corral, her hands tied to the rail.
You an Injun, ain't you? You can ride bareback.
Boot assumed from the condition of the saddles that the horses had not been ridden recently, so after he threw the saddle on Wendell's bay pony, he stepped aboard to test the spirit of the animal. Unable to buck its burden out of the saddle, the horse then attempted to scrape Boot off against the rails. As before, Boot avoided catastrophe and remained in the saddle. When the bay exhausted its efforts and submitted to its new master, Boot dismounted. Then he tied the reins to a post and fetched a pitchfork from the lean-to that served as a barn. Approaching the weary horse again, he whacked it across the face with the handle of the pitchfork. Boot then grabbed the bridle and pulled the bay's head down.
I reckon you know who's the boss now, you son of a bitch. Next time you try to buck me off, I'm gonna put a bullet in your pea brain.
Untying Lily then, Boot pulled the cringing Creek girl over to the mare. Holding her wrist in one hand, he grabbed a handful of her hair with the other.
These horses, these rifles, this pistol, these packs, they all belong to me. Because I was strong enough to take them. You understand? You understand?
Yes.
This horse tries to run away. I shoot him. You understand?
Yes.
You belong to me, just like that horse and those rifles. You ever try to run away, you get the same as the horse. You understand that?
Her eyes answered without being asked. He put her on the mare's back then, and holding the reins in one hand, climbed up on the bay. Crossing over to the west bank, he headed north, following the river. Dusk found them only 2 hours away from the grim scene Boot had left behind. He continued on until he found a place to camp that suited him. With fingers trembling almost uncontrollably, Lily built the fire, using flint and steel that Boot had found in the cabin. While she bent over the flame, he sat down with his back against a log, watching her. When the fire showed signs of permanent life, he pointed toward the packs.
Cook me something to eat.
After he had his fill of bacon and beans, he told her to eat. Still too terrified to be hungry, she nevertheless attempted to stuff some of the food down. When she finished, she started to take the pan down to wash it, but he stopped her.
Leave it for now. You can wash it later. Come here.
The moment she feared had come. There was no mistaking the look in his eye.
I said come here, damn it!
The stark expression of fright in her eyes brought a malicious smile to his face.
I ain't gonna hurt you. Hell, we're gonna have some fun.
He got up and went to her.
Please don't. Please don't hurt me. I'm your sister.
Hell, you ain't my sister. Even if you was, it wouldn't make no difference. I've been locked up for 12 years, and I'm damn sure overdue.
Twisting her arm, he forced her down on the riverbank and immediately started pulling at her clothes. It was a nightmare that would recur daily for the next few days. Jacob Mashburn hauled back on the traces of his plow mule, pulling it to a stop when he spotted two riders approaching down near the river. He leaned on the plow for a few moments while squinting against the sun in an effort to identify them. It appeared to be a man and a woman, and they were evidently coming to his place since they had veered away from the river. Within 50 yards of his garden now, the two riders were still unrecognizable to Jacob.
Mr. Jacob Mashburn.
Yes, sir?
It's been a while. But you look pretty much the same as the last time I saw you.
I swear, mister, you got the advantage on me. I can't remember you. Must have been a while back.
12 years and some. I expect I've changed a little. Prison will do that to a man. You was pretty damn sure you knew me when you pointed your finger at me in that courtroom. Oh!
Boot looked up to see Lucille Mashburn running toward them.
Come on. Let's see who we can find in the house.
Just as he had done in his parents' house, Boot ransacked the place, taking what was useful and destroying the rest. Finding a silver chain with a cross, he tossed it to Lily.
Put it on. It's a good luck charm.
For himself, he took a gold watch and a handful of gold coins he found in a box under the bed. He rummaged through a trunk at the foot of the bed.
Well, looky here.
He found a silk vest that delighted him so much he had to put it on immediately.
How you like your man now?
They spent the night at Jacob Mashburn's place, in his bed. This time, Lily made no attempt to fight him. When he was finished with her, he tied her wrists to the bedpost, leaving her to sleep as best she could. The next morning, Boot set fire to Mashburn's house and watched it burn for a few minutes while he thought of the 12 long years he had waited to exact his vengeance. There had been few nights when he had not lain awake thinking about the man who had testified against him. He had vowed that he would destroy the man completely, wipe him off the face of the earth, along with his family. That promise had been fulfilled now, but he felt no satisfaction that the debt had been paid for his years of incarceration. In a sudden burst of anger, he pumped more slugs into Mashburn's body. Later, they crossed back over the river, striking out east toward the Boston Mountains near the Missouri border. Nothing about the man would cause a person to stare openly. On a public street, one might pass him by without so much as a casual glance. That is to say, unless you happened to notice him standing next to another man, then you might possibly notice the width of his shoulders, or the discerning eye that quietly evaluated his surroundings. John Ward would hardly be regarded as a handsome man, but there was an honesty in his face that reflected a solid core deep inside him, evidence of an inner strength and patience. Patience. Some on the wrong side of the law might call it relentlessness, for John Ward was well known among the rabble of fugitives who sought refuge in Oklahoma Territory. It had been a long hunt, almost 2 weeks since he had struck Rafe Wilson's trail just north of the Winding Stair Mountains. Doggedly, John had followed Rafe through the Winding Stairs, across the Kiamishi River, and into the mountains of the same name. From camp to camp, he had tracked the fugitive from Judge Parker's jail in Fort Smith all the way to where he now sat in the saddle, looking down at a shanty that served as a saloon on the banks of the Red River. In no particular hurry, now that his quarry was in sight, he studied the horse tied out front of the dilapidated cabin. It was without question the red roan Rafe had stolen when he escaped from jail. A wild young fella, Rafe had only 6 months left to serve on an attempted bank robbery conviction. Now he could look forward to an extended stay in the jail below the courtroom in Fort Smith, with jailbreak and horse thievery added on. John shook his head in bored amazement at the antics of such hot-headed young men. He nudged his horse gently, and the big buckskin gelding took him down to the river. Pulling up beside the roan, he eased his Winchester out of the saddle sling and dismounted. John stepped up into the room. Though still early in the evening, the inside of the cabin was bathed in darkness, relieved only by a lantern on the end of the crude bar.
Rafe Wilson?
Scully, the saloon's startled proprietor, almost fell off the chair back he'd been perched upon. Rafe, on the other hand, was too far into the bottle to react instantly. He turned around to scowl at the lawman.
Who the hell wants to know?
John Ward.
Finish your drink, Rafe. It's the last one you'll have for a while.
Oh, who the hell are you?
I'm a deputy marshal, and I expect you know why I'm here. Now get on your feet.
The hell I will. You can't arrest me. I'm in Texas.
You're still in Indian territory. Texas is across the river. You just set yourself down in that chair, Scully. I'm not going to tell you again, Rafe. Get on your feet.
All right. I'll go peaceable.
Rafe shuffled his feet under him and started to get up. Halfway up, he made a sudden lunge and turned with his pistol in his hand, but the deputy had been expecting something of the sort. He cracked Rafe across the head with the barrel of the Winchester.
I expect we can get started back to Fort Smith now, unless there's some more tricks you'd like to try.
He reached down, grabbed Rafe by the back of his collar with one hand, and dragged him across the floor.
Get on your feet.
I'm trying to, damn it.
Rafe grasped the door jamb in an effort to help himself up.
You cracked my skull.
Hey, wait a minute, John Ward. He owes me for all the whiskey he drank.
I expect you just poured that rot gut into him out of the kindness of your heart. I doubt if Rafe here has two bits to his name.
Oh, I ain't got no money.
Why, you low-down son of a bitch. That whiskey cost me a lot of coin.
I doubt that.
John helped a still-staggering Rafe Wilson up in the saddle.
How about you, Marshal? You could stand a little drink before you start back, couldn't you?
I reckon not.
John tied Rafe's hands together and secured them to his saddle. He tied the reins of Rafe's horse behind his own saddle. Without another glance at the distraught bartender, he climbed up on the buckskin and headed back the way he had come. There were no more than a couple of hours left before dark, but John rode the horses hard until stopping to make camp. When they finally stopped for the night, John noticed a sizable streak of vomit down the roan's withers. Feeling more compassion for the horse than he did for the man, he dipped some water from the river and doused the horse's side.
I'll make us some coffee.
John pulled the man off the horse.
Maybe that'll cut some of that whiskey in your gut, if there's any whiskey left in you.
After a while, and some of John's coffee, the prisoner regained a measure of stability, even to the point of trying to eat a little of the hardtack John offered.
I'd just as soon you shoot me instead of taking me back to that stinking jail in Fort Smith.
I expect I could do that. Make it easier to carry you. But Judge Parker frowns on having to try a dead man.
I've heard him talk about you in Fort Smith. They said you was a reasonable man. You ought not to send a man back to that hell on the border.
Rafe paused, trying to determine if his words were having any effect.
You know, you was right. I ain't got no money on me. But I know where I can get my hands on a bunch of it. I'd be willing to split it with you 50-50 if you was to just let me get on my way to Texas.
Well, now, that's hard to pass up. I'll think it over while we ride back to Fort Smith. Meanwhile, let's get a little sleep. We'll be riding hard tomorrow. Come on.
Oh, what are you doing?
Tying you to a tree for the night.
Oh, damn.
5 days of hard riding found John Ward leading a sullen and subdued Rafe Wilson through the streets of Fort Smith. He made straight for the jail, where he turned his prisoner over to Seth Tompkins, the jailer.
I'll tell the judge you didn't try to cause any trouble on the way back. Maybe he'll go a little easier on you.
Thanks, I guess.
A few minutes later, John was sitting, hat in hand, patiently waiting outside Judge Isaac Parker's office. After a considerable wait, the office door finally opened, and Judge Parker escorted two well-dressed citizens of Fort Smith out into the hall. The two gentlemen barely cast an eye in the direction of the weather-bronzed, trail-worn individual waiting to see the judge.
Come on in, John. Glad to see you made it back all right. I assume you brought Wilson back with you?
Yes, sir. He's back in jail.
Any trouble?
No, sir. No trouble. He came back real peacefully.
Good job, John. I expect you're probably ready to take a little time off. You've been going at it pretty steady for the past few months.
Well, I have been thinking about doing a little hunting and fishing. Maybe take a couple of weeks off if there's nothing you've got for me right away.
Nah, you go on and enjoy yourself. I wish I could go fishing with you.
Thank you, sir.
The judge stood behind his desk and watched the quiet lawman until John carefully closed the door behind him. Then he sat down and started to look through the court docket for the following week, only to become bored with it after a few seconds. It had been a long and busy morning. He stood up and walked to the window. Looking down on the street below, he saw John Ward as the broad-shouldered deputy marshal descended the steps of the courthouse and walked toward his horse.
A good man.
A big man. Yet he moved with a certain animal grace that suggested the reflexes of a cat. Relentless was the word that always came to mind when Parker thought of John Ward. And John was always his first choice to handle the most dangerous assignments. Possibly he was being unfair when he singled out the quiet lawman for the most difficult and dangerous jobs. In his defense, however, he would cite the fact that John Ward was a loner. He had no family to worry about, no wife waiting at home to cause him to hesitate in a life-threatening situation, no children who might become fatherless if his reactions ever proved to be a bit too slow. John Ward was not burdened with a complicated mind. He saw the right of things and acted accordingly. Uncomplicated, but by no means simple-minded. Parker shook his head in admiration, thankful that the sometimes dispassionate lawman worked for him. A few days later, John Ward laid the bridle he had been mending in his lap and glanced up toward the tiny trail that led to his cabin on the Poteau River, waiting to see who his visitor might be. After a few seconds passed, a horse's head appeared, pushing through the juniper bushes that lined the narrow path. John recognized the rider as Nate Simmons and knew his little vacation was most likely about to end. He set the bridle aside and got up to greet Nate.
John Ward?
Nate?
Why the hell don't you cut a decent road into this place?
John didn't bother to answer.
Judge Parker sent me after you. He said to tell you it was important, and he needs to see you right away.
The message didn't surprise John, in spite of the fact that he had just left the judge no more than 3 days before. Whenever he was summoned personally by Judge Isaac C. Parker, it was always important, and it usually meant someone had to be tracked down.
Know what the judge has got on his mind?
I don't for a fact, John. Have you got anything to cut the dust in my throat? I swear it's a dusty ride out from Fort Smith.
Yeah, I reckon it is. Especially since we've had rain for the last 2 days. Come on inside. I think I got a bottle around here somewhere.
He went to a tiny cupboard and took a bottle from the top shelf. From the lower shelf, he took a cup, then handed them both to Nate.
Help yourself. The judge didn't say anything more about it?
Nope. But if I had to guess, I suspect it might have something to do with some trouble over in the nations. Somebody sent word last week about some killings over in the Neosho.
All right. I'll get a few things together and ride back with you. I reckon Judge Parker gave you instructions to fetch me back with you.
Well, yeah, I reckon.
It didn't take John long to get ready. He traveled light. The buckskin John had named Cousin plodded obediently over to his master. John saddled the horse, walked over to pull the cabin door to, then stepped up on the buckskin.
Ain't you got no lock on that door?
If somebody wants to get in that cabin while I'm gone, I'd prefer they didn't break the door down.
He turned the buckskin's head toward the trail and led them out to strike the road to Fort Smith. Judge Parker looked up from his desk.
Well, it appears Nate Simmons didn't have any trouble finding you.
The open doorway was filled with the formidable figure of Deputy Marshal John Ward.
No, sir. I was at the cabin.
Parker motioned toward a chair.
John, I know you were planning to take a little time to do some hunting and fishing, but, something's come up, and I need you to take care of it.
Yes, sir.
We got a real wild one raising hell in the nations. A killer. And I'm afraid he's going to do a lot more if we don't stop him. We know who he is, a half-breed Cherokee named Boot Stoner. He's the son of Wendell Stoner and an Indian woman. Stoner ran a trading post on the Grand River in the Cherokee Nation. You most likely knew him.
I did. Has something happened to Wendell?
He and his Indian wife were murdered by their son. Boot Stoner was released from the penitentiary in Little Rock 2 weeks ago. He was supposed to report in here, but he failed to do so. He was identified by two Indians at his father's store. They were certain it was the same boy who was sent away 12 years ago. And the next day, another Indian went to the store and found Wendell and his wife dead.
Well, that is a pure shame. There was a daughter, a young girl, about 14 or 15.
Yeah, she's missing. At least, if he killed her, the body wasn't found. I expect Boot must have taken her with him. We found out also that a man and his wife and a little girl were murdered just outside of Little Rock on the same day Boot was released. Their home was on the road he most likely would have taken. I wouldn't be surprised if that was more of Boot's work.
The judge gestured toward a map of Indian territory behind him on the wall.
John, this savage has to be stopped. He's leaving a bloody trail across the whole territory. He's been out of prison for only 2 weeks, and already 5 people have been murdered and 1 young girl abducted. How soon can you ride?
I reckon I can start out for Stoner's trading post as soon as I leave here. I'll need to pick up some extra cartridges for my rifle.
Fine. I knew I could count on you. I'll give you a voucher for your ammunition.
Parker got to his feet and extended his hand.
And John, you be damn careful.
Yes, sir.
John sighted the store late in the afternoon of the third day out. There was enough daylight left to take a look around Stoner's house and store. He found a couple of fresh graves and a grove of cottonwood trees.
Probably dug by the native police or friends of Wendell's.
Stoner's store was about 12 miles from Tahlequah, the little town that had become the capital of the Cherokee Nation. And that was most likely where the Cherokee police had ridden from, since it was closer than Fort Gibson. The trading post was probably a little over 18 miles from the army post. Fort Gibson was located on the same river as Stoner's in an area the Cherokee called Muscogee, about 3 miles from the convergence of that river with the Arkansas and the Verdigris. John studied a set of tracks that led north along the river.
Huh.
They were fresher than the other tracks around the store. 2 horses, both carrying riders, or 1 rider and a pack horse. He felt fairly certain that this was the trail he was looking for. Glancing over his shoulder at the sun, which was almost resting on the distant hills, he knew his search would have to continue the next day. A hunter accustomed to riding alone, he methodically went about the routine of making his camp. Like any man who lived in the wild, he took care of his horse first, leading the buckskin down to the water to drink. Afterward, knowing that Wendell Stoner wouldn't mind, especially now, he found some oats in the lean-to back of the corral and gave Cousin a generous measure. The horse was accustomed to surviving on prairie grass, so it was appreciative of the occasional treat. After Cousin was taken care of, John hobbled the horse and left it to graze while he gathered some wood for a fire. It wasn't absolutely necessary to hobble the buckskin. The horse wouldn't wander far. But John wanted it close in case he needed it in a hurry. He took a look around in the store in case there was anything useful left, but the shelves were stripped bare. No doubt the folks who buried Wendell and Morning Light had seen no reason to leave useful items on the shelves.
Ain't nothing I really need, anyway.
Instead of using Wendell's cabin, he chose to camp outside in the open, near the water. After a meal of coffee and bacon, he rolled up in his blanket, using his saddle as a pillow, and was soon asleep.
Huh?
His eyes blinked open, awakened by something. He wasn't sure what. Feeling not fully awake, he nevertheless reacted automatically. Rolling over on his stomach, he pulled his rifle up close to him and waited, listening. He could see nothing moving in the darkness of the moonless night, but he knew something had jarred him from sleep. John's buckskin was aware of another horse nearby. After carefully freeing himself from his blanket, he rolled away from his saddle in the firelight. Once in the deeper darkness, he crawled up to the edge of the cottonwoods where Wendell and his wife were buried and positioned himself where he could watch his camp. Long moments passed with no sign of anything moving. Then he caught sight of a shadow darting from one tree to another along the riverbank, making its way down to his fire. Waiting a few moments longer to make sure there was only one shadow in the trees, John rose silently and worked his way around behind his unannounced visitor. Following along in the intruder's footsteps, he could now determine that it was a man and appeared to be an Indian. He caught up to him just as the Indian pulled a knife from his belt and charged out into the firelight, heading for John's saddle. Acting quickly, John kicked the Indian's heel. The Indian rolled over at once, only to find himself staring into the muzzle of John's Winchester.
Two-buck!
John recognized the young Cherokee who sometimes worked for Wendell Stoner.
John Ward! Don't shoot! I didn't know it was you!
John lowered the rifle.
Hell, Two-Buck, I'm not gonna shoot you. What the hell are you doing here?
Two-Buck got to his feet and put the knife back in its sheath.
I saw your fire. I thought you were a boot, maybe. Come back. How did you hear me, anyway?
My horse. He must have smelled yours back in the trees there.
John stepped back past Two-Buck and picked up a stick to poke up the fire.
What made you think Boot Stoner would be here in the middle of the night?
I don't know. I just thought I'd come back. I didn't think anybody'd be here. Then I saw your fire. I'd like to kill that son of a bitch.
You were the one that buried Wendell in Morning Light, weren't you?
Yes.
John knew that Two-Buck was quite fond of Wendell and his wife. Wendell had let him take care of the horses and do odd jobs around the store. Over the years since Boot had been in prison, Two-Buck had become more of a son to Wendell than Boot had ever been. So it was little wonder the young man wanted to exact vengeance on the half-breed.
The soldiers sent you to look for Boot?
Well, no, not the soldiers. Judge Parker sent me to get him.
Let me go with you. I can help you track.
I don't know. I ain't used to working with anybody, and there ain't no telling how long this is gonna take.
I don't care how long it takes. We gotta find him.
Well, all right. You can go till you start getting in my way.
Oh, I won't get in your way, John Ward. I'll help you.
Yeah, I reckon.
John suspected that Two-Buck was more concerned with rescuing Lily than he was over punishing Wendell's murderer.
We'll start at first light. Now, damn it, I need to get some sleep.
Two-Buck and John had followed the obvious trail left by Boot and his captive for half a day.
They're heading for Mr. Mashburn's place.
Looks that way.
John had met Jacob Mashburn once when riding through the nations, but he really didn't know the man. They continued on for the better part of 2 hours, following the tracks of two horses before first sighting the flock of buzzards in the distance.
That doesn't look good.
There must have been 20 or more of the grisly birds, forming a macabre cloud just beyond a line of trees by the river. Once they passed the trees, they saw the burned-out ruins of Mashburn's house and the cause for the great gathering of scavenger birds. It was a feast on a grand scale, and by this time, almost finished. There were carcasses strewn about the corral and outbuildings, most of them cattle, some mules, all of them almost totally devoid of flesh. Closer to the house, John spotted the remains of Jacob and his wife, already little more than skeletons, their clothes ripped and shredded by the sharp beaks and claws of the diners. John and Two Buck were stopped cold for a few long seconds, repulsed by the grisly scene before them. After rescuing the remains of Jacob and his wife, they carried them down behind the ruins of their house for burial. It was a grim and pitiful funeral for the man and wife.
That's about all we can do for them.
John didn't comment on it, but he was thinking that Boot Stoner had a bloodlust that went beyond burning and looting. He suspected the half-breed had begun killing for the sheer satisfaction it brought him. If that was the case, John feared that anyone in Boot's path had just been served a death warrant. He was afraid there was a mad dog loose who was going to leave a bloody trail across the territory.
We're done here. Look for a trail out of here.
As before, there was no effort on Bootstoner's part to cover his trail. It would have been difficult to hide at any rate, even as old as it was. Two horses, two mules, and what appeared to be a cow left a clear path away from the Mashburn Ranch, leading toward the mountains east of the river. Feeling a renewed urgency, John started out at an easy lope with Two Buck close behind. The half-breed's trail led them into the mountains, following a stream that led to a small meadow. Here, Boot had made camp and butchered the cow. From the evidence left behind, he had remained there for 2 or 3 days before leaving the mountains again and striking out to the northwest. John paused to watch Two Buck as the young Cherokee studied the sign left in the campsite. Meticulously examining every scrap of evidence, footprints, bent twigs, disturbed brush and grass, the young man was trying anxiously to create a picture in his mind. After watching for a while, John expressed the thought that Two Buck was wrestling with.
Appears she's still alive.
Looks that way. That son of a bitch needs killing bad. The Stoners were decent people.
That's a fact. I know it ain't good to think about, but there's no telling what kind of condition we're likely to find Lily in, even if she's still alive. You'd best not get your hopes up too high.
In the saddle again, they followed Boot's trail out of the hills. After reaching the valley once more, John pulled up and searched the land before him.
The way he's heading, he'll strike the Neosho again.
It was anybody's guess where Boot was going. Maybe Boot didn't know himself. But if he continued in the same direction, he'd soon end up in Kansas. The fact that Kansas was out of John's jurisdiction bothered the lawman not in the least. When it came to hunting down a mad dog, John didn't concern himself with legal boundaries. If he had to go to Canada to get Boot, that was where he would go.